happen without fail. If a person lost hope, their body would shut down and they would die within a few days. And so Frankl wrote this in his book. Any attempt to restore a man's inner strength in the camp had first to succeed in showing him some future goal. In other words, what this world-famous psychiatrist is saying is, we gain strength and we are able to actively move into the future when we possess hope. And if we lose that hope, we become paralyzed, we become inactive, and even physically, our bodies can shut down and can lead to death. A world-famous psychiatrist is saying that, and we're seeing the Bible is basically saying the same thing. We're seeing it here in the story of Ruth and Naomi. Naomi knew something of this. You remember in Ruth chapter 1, Naomi's husband and her two sons died. So she had come back to the city of Bethlehem along with her daughter-in-law Ruth, and they were going to begin this new life, but everything had fallen apart. Hope had died in Naomi's heart. Her hope had been replaced with bitterness, and her bitterness had led her into being paralyzed, into just total inactivity. You remember when Ruth suggested to her, let's go glean out in the fields. Her response to her daughter-in-law was kind of terse. It was just, go, daughter. You go do that. And while Ruth went and gleaned out in the fields, Naomi just stayed home, and she didn't do anything. Naomi loses hope because, as we saw in Ruth 1, she no longer believes that God cares for her. And because she's lost that hope, she sees no more reason to go on. Life has fallen apart. And so she sinks into just despairing inactivity. But then in chapter 2, everything changes for Naomi. We discovered this word, this Hebrew word, hased. Hased refers to a loyal covenant love. You're in a relationship with someone, and that love is expressed in relieving a person's needs, in showing acts of kindness. And so in Ruth chapter 2, God's hased comes home to Naomi, and everything changes for her. In chapter 2, the invisible hand of God leads Ruth to glean in the field of Boaz. Boaz is, of course, a distant relative, a relative who could come and marry Ruth, save Naomi's family, get back the family farm, provide food for them. Hope has returned. Boaz shows chesed to Ruth. He gives her a job. He protects her. He promises that she can work in his fields all the time. She doesn't have to go to another field. After one day's work, she gets a few thousand dollars as he purposely and calls his workers to neglect their work and to drop all kinds of extra grain for her to pick up. She makes a few thousand dollars in a day. Boaz says, come back for the rest of the harvest, glean here, and so you can make all kinds of money, basically, so you can survive through the season. This is God's chesed to Naomi and Ruth through Boaz. When Naomi saw that Ruth returned with that huge sack of grain and she realized who it was who did this for her, it was Boaz, everything came together for her. She suddenly saw God's invisible providential hand at work in her life. But not only that, she saw God's chesed. Providence and chesed, she saw both of these, and in that moment, hope resurrected in her heart. For in that moment, she realized that God was not just almighty, he was also good. He's not just sovereign, he's also gracious. Now, that catches us up to where we are today. Here's what I want us to see today in Ruth chapter 3. When these two things come together in your life, when you get God's providence, that his invisible hand guides all events, big and small, he controls all things, and when you get God's chesed, that he, if you are a Christian here today, you're part of his people, that he is showing his love and his grace for you, when providence and chesed come together in your life, it fills you with hope to move into the future. Particularly, it fills you with hope to move into the future by being active. You're no longer paralyzed into inactivity because you've lost hope, but rather you've got providence. Oh, God's guiding my life. You've got chesed. He's with me, not against me. That gives me hope. I can move into the future. I can actively move. I can do things trusting that God is leading me. That's where we're going today. So what I'm going to call us to do today in light of all this is to take what I'm going to call calculated risks in the cause of Christ. Because you see, people who've lost hope are paralyzed into inactivity. But when, like Naomi, you understand providence and you understand chesed, you have confidence in the future. And if you have confidence in the future, you can dream about the future. And dreams, to be accomplished, always take a certain level of risk, don't they? You can plan and plan, but at a certain point, you just have to take steps. You have to take action. And here's the key point for today. If you've got these two things together, you can take those calculated risks, knowing that God is with you and He is guiding you. So let's see how this works out in Naomi's life, how her newfound hope in God's gracious providence spurred her on to activity in order that we also would be spurred on to activity. So this is going to be an old school sermon. I'm going to just do it this way. First, we're going to develop the story. We're just going to walk right through it. And then we're just going to apply the story. That's a really complicated outline, right? Very creative on my part. We're going to develop the story and then we're going to draw out the lessons. That's it. So we're going to take quite a while to go through the story and then we'll draw out a few of the lessons. Let's begin then with developing the story. Chapter 2, at the very end of chapter 2, if you have your Bibles with you, just look back at the last verse. Unfortunately, I didn't print it for you in the worship folder. But that last verse in chapter 2 shows that there's still a problem. Chapter 2 and verse 23, so Ruth kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvest. And here's the problem. She lived with her mother-in-law. No, there's lots of reasons why it could be a problem living with your mother-in-law, but it's not quite maybe what you're thinking. Here's the problem. Harvest was 7 weeks long. At the end of the 7 weeks, Ruth is still living with her mother-in-law. In other words, there's been no development in Ruth and Boaz's relationship. No development over 7 weeks since they met. You can just imagine kind of Ruth talking with Naomi in the evening, like, I just don't get it. You know, I thought we hit it off so well. He hasn't texted me in weeks. He's not even liking any of my Facebook posts about all the grain that I'm bringing home. I'm not hearing from him at all. Like, what's going on? The relationship is not developing. She's still living with her mother-in-law. And in a few days, the harvest is going to be done. And although Boaz has really contributed towards Ruth and Naomi's income for about a year or so, ultimately, the money's going to run out. Ultimately, the food's going to run out. So in many ways, we could say Naomi and Ruth are not much better off than they were at the beginning of chapter 2. Oh yeah, they got food for now, they got an income for a few months and that kind of stuff, but they're not a whole lot further ahead than they were. But Naomi's a different woman now. Naomi has changed. There is no despairing inactivity now. She has experienced God's providential hand in their lives. She has experienced God's chesed towards them. And now Naomi is filled with confidence as she moves into the future. Naomi has a plan. And the plan is risky. Let's look at verse 1, chapter 3. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you that it may be well with you?" What a reversal from chapters 1 and 2. You remember, it's Ruth who for 10 years has shown chesed to Naomi. It's Ruth who has been showing this to Naomi. Now it's flipped. Naomi is, her heart, hope has been rekindled in her heart. Now she is saying to Ruth, "Now it's my turn to show chesed for you." And basically what she's saying is, Ruth, I'm an older woman now. You are a single, widowed Moabite woman. Your odds of getting married here in Bethlehem are not high. I don't want to die and have you all by yourself after all you've done for me. Ruth, I've got a plan. It's risky, but I want to take it. Naomi has a plan to find Ruth a husband. Look with me at verse 2 and 3 for the plan. "Is not Boaz our relative with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. So the plan is going to take place at the threshing floor. Now, it's not exactly a contemporary term, so here's the background. When you pick the wheat, you've got to separate out that kernel from the husk and the stalk. So how do you do that in ancient times? Well, you would take it up east of town, up on a hillside, on a hilltop, and there would be what you call a threshing floor, usually very hard-packed ground, maybe even rock. You put down all the wheat, and then you take heavy objects and you thresh it. So it could be wood. Maybe you'd roll over it, maybe heavy objects you beat it with. The idea is to separate the kernel from the rest of all the stalk and the husk and all that kind of stuff. Now, once you did that, what are you supposed to do? You got this big mess on the ground. You're supposed to sit and pick out every single kernel. Well, that would take forever, wouldn't it? So what the harvesters would do is they'd get shovels. They'd take the shovel, take a big huge scoop, and then they throw it up into the air. And this is during the evening, so the wind is now blowing. You're up on top of the hilltop, and as you throw it up, all the lighter chaff would just kind of blow away, and the heavier kernels would fall to the ground, so then you could gather it up. So Naomi's saying, I want you to go out to the threshing floor, and usually the owner of the field didn't do this job. Usually he would hire his harvesters to do this work for him. But for some reason, Naomi knows that Boaz is going to be at the threshing floor on this night. How does she know that? We don't know, but she's a good mother-in-law. She makes it her business to know. Right? She then lays out her plan for Ruth, which we just read. It's got five steps to it. Ladies, pay attention to this. Very important dating tips here for you. First of all, take a bath. That was the first part. Wash yourself, right? Take a bath. I mean, that's very important in getting a man. If he only sees you out there with your hair pulled back in a bun and no makeup on and all dirty, you know, it's not super attractive. And so, first of all, Naomi says, look, Ruth, first thing, you got to take a bath. Second of all, she says, I want you to put on some of that Moabite perfume that just drives all the guys crazy. So, you know, anoint yourself. That's with perfume and stuff. Three, very important, get dolled up in your finest clothes. You know, you don't just go out there in your work clothes. Put on that nice little number you bought at H&M last week, you know, something like that. You put on that good thing and you'd get dressed up and you head on over there. Step four, this is very important. Go to where Boaz is. Now, ladies, I know guys are supposed to be the ones who initiate the relationship with you, but guys, sometimes they're missing a few marbles. They can miss a good thing. I don't know why this is, you know, distracted by video games, distracted by sports, and they just sometimes don't even see the beautiful woman that's just living close by to them. They don't even notice. So what Naomi is saying here is, listen, just go to where he is. So ladies, you don't have to throw yourself at a guy, but there's nothing wrong with kind of coincidentally putting yourself in front of him. You know, that's kind of what she's doing here, right? Oh, Johnny, you're going to be at the party tonight too. I didn't know you were going to be here. What a coincidence, right? Oh, this old number. I know. I just threw it on. Thanks for the compliment, though. You know, put yourself in front of the man. That's what Naomi's saying she needs to do, so he'll notice you. And of course, this is going to accomplish at least two things. First of all, it's going to signal to Boaz that Ruth's period of mourning for her now deceased husband is over. In other words, she's available. And secondly, it's going to show him that she's interested. And then here's part five to the plan. Make sure the timing is right. This is really important. Naomi, of course, has been a married woman for decades. Naomi is a woman who gets men. As a previously married woman, she understands how men think. She understands that timing is everything. So basically, she's saying to Ruth, don't just go running up to Boaz and be like, Boaz, I thought we were more than just friends, and I don't know anymore, and you don't talk to me, and Boaz, like, I just feel like we need to define our relationship for the next few hours. You know, that'll freak the guy out. Right? And so many girls do that. They freak out the guy, you know, there's all the tears and define the relationship, and the guy's just like, wow, I don't even know what's happening here. So here, it's really simple, actually. If you want a dating tip, this is an ancient one, and it still works today. I don't know why it is, but God has tied a man's mind and his emotions and his thinking process to his stomach. And so Naomi's saying, don't just go in there and start talking to him. You wait until he's fully eaten his meal, he's had a couple of glasses of wine, and then when he's nice and comfortable, that's when you go and speak with him. Do not do it before. Naomi's a wise woman. She knows what to do. Now the plan gets weird. It's a little risky, and I'll say this, it's also risque. Verse 4. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies, then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. I'm sure he will. She needs to observe the place where he lies down. Now, that's important because it's going to be pitch black. There's no lights out here. Pitch black at night. It'd be really embarrassing if you went to the wrong guy. That would be bad. It would also be very embarrassing if it's pitch black and you wanted to go talk to him about your whole future together and you accidentally, like, kneed him in the nose and he got a bloody nose and, you know, now timing is really messed up for a conversation about marriage. So observe where he lies. And then we have this strange comment about uncovering his feet. Now, what in the world is going on here? We don't get this as modern readers, but in ancient times, this word foot actually includes the whole lower leg. So she's supposed to go and kind of uncover his lower leg, not up to his privates. This is still proper. This is a very proper thing, though it is a bit sensuous. Because the lower leg, to do this, it has a little bit of a sexual overtone to it. It's meant to picture a husband and wife lying beside one another in bed, but in a proper way. There's nothing wrong about what this is doing, but it is a suggestive thing that she's supposed to do. And so she goes and does this, and it's supposed to picture all this, and basically what Ruth is saying is, I'd like to be your wife. Now, let's just pause in the story for a moment. Let's reflect on this plan. Let me give you four reasons why this plan is risky and why it's risque. First of all, it's very risky because going out at dusk, looking really beautiful as Ruth was going to be after she was all dolled up and had that Moabite perfume going on, this is not a good idea. Remember, this is the period of the judges, and bad things happen to women during the period of the judges. So it's dangerous, this plan. Second of all, Boaz could just end up mocking her. I mean, he could just say to her, you want me to marry you? I'm a man of standing and of wealth, and you're poor. I'm a Jew, you're a Moabite. You're nothing but a gold digger. You're just trying to get my money. You're using me for your social standing. You're trying to climb the ladder through me. Get lost. It's a risky plan. What if he responds like that? Third, Boaz could also take advantage of her. Think about this. It's pitch black. He could rape her and then turn around and accuse her of trying to seduce him, and it would simply be his word against her word. It's a dangerous plan. Fourth, Boaz may mistake her, he may mistake her intentions. He may think, accuse her of being immoral, and here's why. Again, we got to get back in an ancient mindset. In ancient times, the threshing floor was the place where ritual prostitution happened, where other cultures like the Moabites would go, a ritual prostitute would come up there, would sleep with the harvester or with the owner of the field, with the idea being, if we do this, the gods, the fertility gods, will then bless the harvest. We see this in Hosea chapter 9, where God rebukes his people and he says, quote, you have been unfaithful to your God. You love the wages of a prostitute at every threshing floor. Not only that, Moabite women had a reputation for sexual immorality. You remember back in Numbers chapter 25, Moabite women lead Israelite men into sexual immorality. So Boaz could very easily mistake Ruth's intentions as something along those kind of lines and then, you know, kind of run away and accuse her of being a ritual prostitute and of being immoral. But notice what Ruth says to Naomi after this whole plan is laid out. Verse 5. And she replied, all that you say, I will do. So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. Now let's find out what happens in verse 7. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. He said, "Who are you?" Now, Boaz is waking up, right? He's startled. It's midnight. He smells some of that Moabite perfume. He knows all about these kind of ritual prostitutes, threshing floors, Moabite women, and you can just hear, it's in the dark, and you kind of hear this terse whisper, "Who are you? Who's there? Who is that?" Verse 9. And she answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." Now, these words were pre-planned. She had one sentence to say, and it had to make sure that it connected. You can't spend some time in small talk. You know, this was pre-planned words. Now, some of your translations might have spread the corner of your garment over me. Same thing, it works, whatever. It kind of has both the images. They both signify protection. The corner of a garment, you know, is the corner of the bed. It's the quilt, basically, in our Canadian terms. I'm sure their quilts weren't as thick as ours, living in a hot climate. But the idea is, of course, if a woman comes to share a bed with a man as his wife, she is now under his protection. It's an image that goes there. Same image of the mother eagle with her wings over top of her young. Really, she's saying, this is the equivalent of saying, "Boaz, would you put a ring on it?" That's really what she's saying. Put the corner of your garment over me, I'm asking you. What Ruth is doing is Ruth is proposing that Boaz propose. That's kind of more that subtle way of doing things. Ruth is doing this, and now remember what Boaz had prayed. Do you remember this prayer? Back in chapter 2, verse 12, if you have your Bibles, look at it. This prayer is really important to what Ruth said. In 2 and verse 12, Boaz had prayed this, that Yahweh repay Ruth for what you have done, that is, done for her mother-in-law and caring for her, that Yahweh repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given to you by Yahweh, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Sound familiar? In other words, this would have triggered, she said these words on purpose, these are pre-planned. She's saying, "Boaz, you asked that Yahweh, the God of Israel, would richly reward me, and that I, the Moabite woman who've left my gods, left my culture, come under Yahweh's wings, become one of his people. You've asked that Yahweh would care for me, that he would protect me and reward me, and now I'm asking you to put your wings over me." In other words, I'm asking that you would be the fulfillment for your own prayer. And the reason she asked this, she says, is because Boaz is a redeemer, or a kinsman redeemer. We learned about this last week. A kinsman redeemer was a person who had an obligation to buy his relative's property if they had passed away in order to buy it back for the family, in order to pay off all the debts. We also saw that under certain circumstances, a kinsman redeemer, if it was the brother, for instance, of the deceased man, he would marry the widowed woman and again be able to carry on the family line so that the family line would not die. But listen, Boaz is not really under obligation for this, if I'm reading this right. First of all, Boaz is not Ruth's deceased husband's brother. He's in the line of Elimelech. So Ruth's husband died. This is not Ruth's husband's brother. You follow? So it doesn't technically apply there. And it doesn't seem to technically apply also because God's law didn't say anything about what you're supposed to do with foreign women who'd kind of illegally married into the people of God. So if Boaz was obligated by law, Ruth could have just walked up and said, "You're obligated, do this." That's not the way her and Naomi approach it. It seems that what's going on here is that Ruth is appealing to Boaz to act in accordance with what we would call the spirit of the law. In other words, it may not exactly say he has to. He's more of a distant relative through Naomi's line. But she's asking him as an extended relative to rescue her and Naomi at cost to himself, not because he has to necessarily, but because he wants to. Now, how does Boaz respond? Remember, it's dark. This woman has basically just now professed love. She's smelling great. And she's looking great. Stars are shining. It's a beautiful night. Your legs already uncovered. Where does Hollywood take this one? You know how Hollywood would take this one. But that's not where this one goes with Ruth and with Boaz. They do not throw themselves into their passion immediately. All through the book of Ruth, Ruth and Boaz are pictured, are portrayed for us as people of unmatched integrity. So here's how it goes, verse 10. And he said to her, "May you be blessed by Yahweh, my daughter. You have made this last," and here's the word, "hased. You've made this last kindness, this last hased, greater than the first, and that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich." Ruth's first act of hased was to care for her mother-in-law. You remember this? Not going back to Moab along with her other sister-in-law, but rather, "Mother-in-law, I'm going to care for you." That was her first act of hased. Her second act of hased now is she has not gone after younger, poorer men for the sake of love. She has not gone after younger, richer men for the sake of riches. Rather, she has gone after a middle-aged man. And she's done it to preserve her family line, to rescue Naomi, to get back the family farm. She is doing this out of love for her mother-in-law. Again, see how selfless Ruth is. What an example. Verse 11. "And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask. For all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman." That same phrase, "a worthy person," was used of someone else in the story. Do you remember who it was? Remember back? Chapter 2 and verse 1, it was used of Boaz. He was a man of worthy character. So what kind of doesn't seem like a great match? He's a kind of older, middle-aged guy. She's a younger, widowed Moabite. Doesn't seem like they're very compatible. Actually, a lot of compatibility. They're both people of high character. Character is what stands out for them. Proverbs 31 uses the exact same word as here. It says, "A wife of noble character or worthy character, who can find? She is worth far more than rubies." Ruth is that kind of woman. So in other words, at this point in the story, the plan has worked. I mean, as the audience, we want to cheer now. Ruth and Boaz, they're getting together. All right, the Celine Dion song starts playing. The credits are starting to roll. The love story is done. And then, boom, everything stops. Verse 12, Boaz makes a comment. "And now it is true that I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I." Oh, what? After all of this, I mean, here, Ruth and Naomi have this whole plan. Everything has worked perfectly. And now he's saying, actually, there's somebody who is closer by law than I am as a redeemer, closer related, who would have basically first choice on this. Ruth's just thinking, oh, seriously? Verse 13 and 14. Boaz says, "Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as Yahweh lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning." So she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. And he said, "Let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor." Again, here we see the character of Boaz. He knows how dangerous it would be for her to walk home at night, and so he says, "No, stay here until just before the sun rises." He also knows what it would look like for others to see a Moabite woman leaving his threshing floor. It would not look good for her reputation. It would not look good for his. So he's already protected her chastity in not sleeping with her, and now he protects her reputation as well. Again, what a great guy. Verse 15. And he said, bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out. So she held it out, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city. In other words, Boaz does not want Ruth to go off. And as she starts to think about it, go, maybe I've misunderstood something here. Maybe I read into that too much. He doesn't want that to happen. And so he measures out which is probably the equivalent of 80 pounds of grain. It's a pledge, what he's saying. I'm going to give you this wealth so that you know that I will follow through with what I said. Now imagine Naomi. She's been at home all night. She probably hasn't slept. She's up thinking the whole time, what happened to Ruth? Did she make it to the threshing floor in the first place? What happened there? And she's, was I clear in my instructions? Maybe I should, all this stuff's going through her mind. And then all of a sudden, Ruth arrives home, verse 16. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did you fare, my daughter? And she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. She replied, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. Now, just quick note there. Who is the grain for? Look at the verse. Who is it for? You must not go back empty-handed. Does it end there? To your mother-in-law. In other words, the grain was a message to Naomi. You remember Naomi had come back to Bethlehem lamenting the fact that God had left her empty, was the word she used. Left her without an heir, left her without anything to continue the family line. Boaz is giving this gift and he's saying, Naomi, your days of emptiness are over. Naomi, he is saying to her, this seed is going to fill your stomach, and when I marry your daughter-in-law, another seed is going to continue on your family line, and I'm going to get back your family farm and fill it with seed too. You're going to be filled, Naomi. And that's how the story ends in chapter 3, at a cliffhanger. Is he going to be able to do this? What if the other Redeemer comes in? What if he wants to marry Ruth? What's going to happen then? Well, it's a cliffhanger for this week. You got to come back next week to continue on with the story. I can go 2 hours if you want. We can keep going. Anyone got anything in the oven? Oh, okay, a couple people. We'll continue on now to drawing out some of the lessons. We've developed the story. Let's shift gears, draw out 3 quick lessons from this story. As we see how hope, when hope is renewed in us, when we get the gracious providence of God, it changes us. And here's 3 ways that when hope is renewed in your heart, you can move into the future. First, renewed hope in the gracious providence of God should inspire calculated risks in the cause of Christ. So when you get your hope renewed in providence and chesed, when these 2 things come together for you and you look into the future, it should inspire you to take calculated risks in the cause of Christ. This is one of the great lessons of the book of Ruth. When, like Naomi, we get both of these things, it should inspire action. Notice Naomi did not just sit back and say, hey, God's providence is at work. We've seen it now. Well, let's just see what he does as far as bringing your husband. And just kind of sit back and go, God will take care of it all. There's a sense in which God will take care of it all, but it also inspires action. Naomi did not just sit back, and same with the Christian life. The Christian life is not just that you become a Christian, now the whole goal is to avoid evil. That's part of it. But you become a Christian, now you know providence, you know has said, you've got the whole future with God there being with you and for you. It should inspire you to move forward in doing good in this world and sharing about Christ and doing things. It should inspire action. And at times, this means taking calculated risks. I'm not talking about foolishness, but think about this. They knew some things about Boaz. They knew he was a worthy man. In other words, a man of character. They knew that he was one of the redeemers, a distant one, but he was. And so they had enough information. They thought, okay, Naomi thought to herself, there's enough information, I can do something. But I mean, this was not a far gone conclusion at all. They had to take a risk in order to move forward. And they once they had as much information as they could, her and Ruth step forward in faith. They step forward with a certain level of risk. And friends, you can do that too. What do you think God's calling you to do with your life? I mean, broad, with your whole life, but just daily. What are certain things that maybe you feel like God's calling me to do this? I don't have all the information. I mean, just personally for our family. You know, moving here for us. We felt like God was calling us. You can do interviews forever. The church can do interviews with me forever. I can interview the church forever. At a certain point, you just got to say, we've got enough information. We're taking a calculated risk here. For us, even adopting our son, Josh. We knew we wanted to adopt. We had a few factors, things we could control. At a certain point, it just came down to, wow, this is one big calculated risk. We do not know what his health issues are. We do not know what his background is. We are just going to have to take on whatever it is that comes our way. A calculated risk, but we believed that God in his providence had led us this way, that God would be with us and for us. And so we just said, we're just going to step out and we're going to start moving. Same with us as a church. I mean, you heard the announcement this morning from the chair of our board saying that, you know, next door has been bought by BC Housing. They're going to use it to house the people from Tent City. This is a major thing for us. This is changing the demographic of the neighborhood. What does this mean for Central Baptist? We're not exactly sure at the moment. But here's what we do know. We want to move into the future, whatever that future is. We want to take action moving into the future because we believe that God's invisible hand guides all things. We believe that he is with us and for us as his people. And so we can step into the future with hope as a church and as individuals. You see how this works? When hope is renewed in you, you can start to take action. I think the great missionary William Carey said it best. Expect great things from God, attempt great things for God. That just captures it. Expect that he'll do great things. He is God and his providential hand is guiding. And then you attempt great things for God. You don't just sit back and just do the minimum kind of stuff or just wait for God to move, so to speak. Sometimes you got to wait, but you got to get out there and you got to do stuff. So what is God calling you to do? That's the first thing. The second lesson is this. Renewed hope in the gracious providence of God should inspire faithfulness in the pursuit of romantic love. So we're just drawing out all these lessons from this chapter, from this story. And what we see is when you get God's providential hand and you get chesed, it should inspire faithfulness in the pursuit of romantic love. I mean, many of you are single here. Here you have a great example in this story of two single people pursuing romantic love in a God-honoring way. Now, we got to say Ruth 3 is not a manual for dating. You know, as someone has said, like, ladies, don't lie down beside a man and then do whatever he tells you. That's really not a good thing. This story does not prescribe how you should date, but it does have some good things to describe what you could do. Okay, so let me draw out three I see from this story very quickly. First of all, be and seek a person of noble character. Be a person of worthy character and seek a person of worthy character. In chapter 2 and verse 1, Boaz is described as a man of worthy or noble character. Here in chapter 3, Ruth is described this way. In fact, Boaz says she is such a woman of noble character, the whole town knows about her character. Wow. Despite what our culture says about feelings and passion and attraction, you know, those things do matter in a relationship. There's something to be said for attraction, but here's what I want to say, especially to you who are younger and you are on this path, here's what I'm noticing. There's too much of that going on. What you need above all is character in yourself, and what you need to seek in a life partner is character. Character is what sustains you. Ever notice all the Hollywood movies, the romance movies, the huge ones? They always end when they get married. Do you know why they end there? It's because that's when the hard stuff starts. Like emotion and passion and attraction, yeah, it blasts you off at the beginning. But what carries you, as many of you will know this, will carry you to your 50th and 60th wedding anniversary is character. Character shows itself in commitment. Character shows itself in forbearance, in forgiveness, in patience. What you need to look for most and what you need to seek to be first is a person of character. Second, be and seek a person who loves Jesus. Ruth and Boaz were spiritually compatible. Ruth had become part of the people of God. She had left her old gods behind. She had become part of the people of God. Boaz was part of the people of God. They were spiritually compatible with one another. She wasn't worshiping the gods of Moab anymore. And if you're single here today, please listen to me on this. Because as a pastor, I've just had so many counseling conversations on this level. If you're single now, you need to decide right now, are you going to marry a person who loves Christ, or are you just going to marry somebody who's nice and who fits well with you? You can do both, but you got to choose, because if you just say, I just want to find someone who will love me, you'll find someone, and then maybe they won't be a Christian, but trust me when I say this, it's too late once the feelings get involved. The feelings get involved and you will not listen to anybody who will come to say to you, but does he love Jesus? You'll say, yeah. But he loves me. And maybe he does. And these things do work out at a certain level. But listen, especially because we're on the ladies right now. Ladies, what you need to seek is not just a nice guy. You need to seek a guy who loves Jesus. When you are spiritually compatible like this, when Jesus is at the center of your relationship, that's the key. That's what produces forgiveness. That's what produces commitment. That's what carries you, shared values. That's why when you have children and you have shared values on how you're going to raise your kids, I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with maybe more spiritually incompatible couples on the wars that go on at home about what happens on Sunday. Dad's watching football. Guess what the teenage boys are going to do when mom wants to go to church? Take a guess on that. They're following Dad. And the amount of difficulties that come out of this, but more than that, it's for your own happiness. That as a couple, you would seek Jesus together. You would try to say, how can we use our life for Jesus' glory? You got to be spiritually compatible, but you got to decide that before you start dating, before feelings get involved. Be and seek a person of worthy character. Be and seek a person who loves Jesus. And finally, be and seek a person of sexual purity. When the stars were shining, when the perfume was smelling great and their hearts were thumping, Ruth and Boaz put the brakes on. As Ephesians 5 says, but among you, there must not even be a hint of sexual immorality. Let's talk to the single guys for a second. Single guys, I'm going to assume that you want to have a marriage one day and you want to have a fulfilling sexual relationship with your wife. Guess when that begins? It begins now. If you want that kind of a relationship, it begins now by being a man of sexual purity. By being a man of sexual purity when you're in front of your computer, when you're on your smartphone, when you're in a hotel room and traveling on business by yourself, when you're watching movies and whatever other entertainment you do. That future relationship with your wife will only be great if you begin it now. You bring those problems into a relationship and it will kibosh the entire thing. So be and seek a person of sexual purity. So whoever's single today, here's what providence does for you. You can trust that God, by his providential hand, is leading you. If it's his will that you get married, he will cause it to come to pass, like Ruth and Boaz. Maybe you're going to have to take some actions in there. Who knows what those will be? But you can move into the future with hope because you've got providence and you've got chesed. So be those kind of person and seek that kind of person. Now, third and finally, renewed hope in the gracious providence of God should inspire worship for the Redeemer. For the Redeemer. Now, perhaps some of you are sitting there and you're squirming a bit from some of the things we just talked about because you know you've blown it. You know you haven't been a person of character. You know, for instance, you've chosen someone. There's not a spiritual compatibility going on there. You know you've blown it in sexual purity. This is the good news that Christianity offers to you. There is good news for all who are recognizing their sin before God, whatever your sin may be. Because the good news of the whole Bible is really the good news of the story of Ruth. Ruth needed a redeemer. We all need a redeemer. We, like Ruth, cannot change our condition. She was dependent on somebody from the outside coming to help her. Her condition was one of helplessness and hopelessness unless a Redeemer came and redeemed her. And that's the position we're all in. All of us have sinned. All of us are that way with God, helpless and hopeless. But friends, the good news of the Bible is God says, I'll do something about it. Ruth went to Boaz and said, can you do something about my condition? I'm just asking. I have nothing to offer you, but can you do something? Can you be my redeemer? And as we go to God and we say, can something be done about our sin? The message of the Bible is, oh yes, God will do something. And what did he do? He sent Jesus as our redeemer. Jesus, our true kinsman, our kinsman in the flesh. God became a man, understanding our weaknesses, walked among us, like Boaz worked to get Ruth. He's going to go through all kinds of steps. Jesus went through all kinds of steps to seek us out. Like Boaz redeemed Ruth at great cost to himself, Jesus, the true and better Boaz, redeems us at the cost of his own blood. And just as Boaz would not rest, that's what Naomi says, would not rest until the work was done, Jesus, the true and better Boaz, will not rest until his work of redemption is done. This is the good news of the Bible. For anyone who's realizing, man, I have blown it. I am just messed up everything. If you come before Jesus and you admit your helplessness and you say, can you do something to redeem me? You say, there's nothing in me that deserves this, but can you do it? He says, not only can I, but I will. And he's there just for the asking. So maybe you're just checking into Christianity. You came right in the middle of this story. You're trying to catch up with it all. But here, let me just boil it all down very simply for you. The Bible says that we've all sinned, but it also says that there is a Redeemer who's come for all, for anyone who would come to him. And it's not complicated. You don't have to come and perfectly clean up your life for him to rescue you, for God to be reconciled to you. You simply have to come to him, bow your knee and say, would you please save me? Would you redeem me? Would you rescue me? Would you forgive my sins? Please redeem me, and he promises to do it out of sheer grace, like Boaz did for Ruth. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for the hope that we have in the gospel. We thank you for the hope that we have that you, the Almighty God, are leading your people's lives, that you are with us and for us, not against us, and what hope that produces in us to move forward in life, to move forward in action, to step out, to take risks. So Lord, I pray that for each person here today, you would show them what that means in their particular life. Whatever actions need to be taken, whatever inactivity and passivity has happened that needs to be put aside, that you would enable us to put that aside and to step forward in serving you more effectively. We thank you for all you've done for us. In Jesus' name, amen.